Well, I guess kind of the 1960s was, I suppose, kind of the main period of time when people started to kind of first notice the pirate stations. There had been some stations of broadcasting before then, but very kind of small operators. But really the whole kind of offshore radio thing in the 1960s was what kind of encouraged people to kind of see that there were kind of radio that they could maybe do which wasn't being done otherwise, and encouraged a lot of kind of teenagers, I suppose, around that time into thinking that maybe they could try out small-scale pirate radio broadcasting. So around kind of the late 60s, really, you started to get stations like Radio Jackie, the Radio Helen Network, Radio Free London, and a few others who were kind of broadcasting on medium wave with kind of usually kind of quite low power. And I suppose they started off really, you know, on a very small scale at that time, very much as kind of a sort of a geeky hobby type thing, I suppose, rather than being kind of anything more professional. And then gradually over time, you know, as things kind of evolved and technology evolved and music tastes evolved, we moved from that through to kind of the early 80s with kind of VHF FM broadcasting starting to come in. And so we saw kind of a big step change then into kind of how things were changing. Then round about kind of 83, 84, there was then this loophole that was discovered in how kind of stations could operate, where it was discovered that, natural fact, the authorities didn't have permission to be able to take away a transmitter unless they'd actually gone to court, first of all, to acquire it to do so. And there was also no reason why you had to give the authorities any details about who you were, so they could never take you to court if you didn't really want to go. So as a result of that, we started to see a number of kind of big commercial operators that were starting to appear around that time. So we had Radio Jackie going 24 hours a day. We had Radio Sovereign, the oldie station, which featured a number of people who'd been involved in offshore stations. We had some of the big kind of soul music stations around that time as well. And so we started to see kind of very much kind of a sort of a change from being smaller scale stuff into really kind of quite commercial operations. And then unsurprisingly, the authorities decided to clamp down on what was going on. And we had kind of a new kind of change in the law, which made it much harder to broadcast then and brought in restrictions and made it possible for them to go and seize it more easily. So we went through kind of the intermediate period, I suppose, around that time when, partly because it was harder to broadcast for operations, it changed a lot of who was involved in it. You know, so whereas before, maybe it didn't really affect your livelihood if you were just kind of doing occasional weekend broadcasting, but it now meant that if you were kind of caught, you were seeing quite substantial fines. Maybe it would affect kind of what was happening in your day job.
So what periods then are you talking about in this, after the change of the law? When did that happen?
So that was 1984 when that happened. So we, in the summer of that year, we saw lots of the big stations close down, and kind of a change in who the operators were, you know. So it was more towards people maybe who kind of had been excluded from the system before, who then didn't have anything to lose, who were starting to broadcast. So around that time, we saw quite a lot of kind of the black and other minority ethnic broadcasters starting to come to the fore. Then round about kind of the mid-80s, we then started to see this kind of change in who was being involved in the stations. And also it started to become, there was kind of ideas around the government licensing community radio stations, which never happened. And as a result of that, we started to see people coming back on the air who had been off on the air previously and maybe who wanted to apply for a license. So we saw this big growth in stations towards the end of the 80s. And also this change in the music scene as well. So around kind of the time of the acid house parties going on, around the time of kind of big raves and things, we started to see the music change as well. So as well as the more traditional kind of dance-oriented music that we had before, soul stations and so on, we started to see the growth perhaps of some of the big operators who are kind of linked to kind of some of the rave scene as well, you know, and starting to see a growth around that. And then in 1990, we then saw the licensing of a number of kind of legal stations. And that again kind of changed who it was who was involved in the pirates. And really it kind of moved things more underground again, perhaps for some time. And then really, you know, that's supposed to be kind of the time really when I kind of got involved in doing other things and had slightly less interest, I suppose, in what was going on. But certainly, you know, the pirates have continued to exist since then, have seen some quite big audiences since then, and scan through the London Dial today and you'll still find many operators on there.
Very good. And we'll come back to perhaps some of the current operators later on. And I think your timeline there gives me a good opportunity now to ask you about the AMFM site, because that's very much the period that you're covering on the site, isn't it? The 80s and the 90s.
Yes. So, I mean, my involvement kind of began really, you know, I'd started kind of in the early 80s listening to stations. And there wasn't really anything that was covering at that time what was going on with them. So I started a magazine, initially called TX Magazine, to try and cover what was happening on the broadcasters. And then from that, it kind of grew from just kind of 50 or so copies a month to eventually kind of selling around kind of almost 1,000 copies a month. We sold it basically like the Virgin Megastore and so on as well. So it was doing quite well around that time. And we also had an information line as well, so anybody could phone up kind of twice a week and find out what new things were happening on the different stations as well. So I was always kind of, I've never actually been involved in stations myself, but always had this interest in listening to them and trying to report on what was going on, because it seemed like it was an important thing that was happening and wasn't really being covered, I felt, enough by kind of the mainstream media.
And did you have any connections with Anorax UK in Blackpool? Because they played a very important role in the documentation of Irish pirate radio history by virtue of the fact that they could hear many of the AM stations on the west coast of Britain.
Yes, well, in the early days of the magazine, Anorax UK actually distributed the initial copies. And they continued to do so for their history as well. So kind of from Barry and Ruth's involvement, we know it was very much key towards kind of helping kind of get the information out and helping kind of get kind of known kind of what it was that we were doing as well. So I owe them a big debt.
Absolutely. And so do all people interested in pirate radio history in this country. And in terms of the site then, Stephen, what's your approach in the way that you present it, and what kind of a range of material do you have there? Is it short air checks or full recordings or interviews, or what's the format?
Well, the site originally started off, I think, around about kind of 2000 or so, actually, maybe a little bit earlier. And it was really just, because I had all this kind of copy from the magazine and various kind of pieces as well that had come out of kind of doing the phone lines as well, which it seemed I may as well kind of now I could do so, put it onto the internet. So initially it was just really just kind of a straight copying of kind of the text stuff of the magazine into kind of the website. Then gradually over time I started to then kind of edit together various tapes that I had of the pirates at the time. And started to kind of include kind of clips and things. And then more recently, I've been going back further through clips and things from elsewhere and putting them on Twitter and YouTube as well, you know, as kind of a helping to kind of keep alive kind of what was going on at that time and kind of showcase some of the things that pirates are capable of, really.
Absolutely. And maybe it would be a good time to introduce some extracts from your website now, because we do have a number of clips to play. So the first clip that we listen to now is from the early 80s, featuring pop and indie stations.
Have you ever had difficulty finding a radio station playing music?
Oh, yeah.
Then here's a tip. Tune to Thameside Radio on 90.2 MHz VHF.
South London Radio. Broadcasting on 94.4 stereo VHF to London and the suburbs, this is Uptown Radio.
Following the raid on Thameside by the Home Office on April the 26th, two members of Thameside's staff appeared at Marylebone Magistrates Court last Tuesday, charged with stealing a quarter of a pence of electricity from Kensington Borough Council.
We're live from somewhere near Highbury and Islington Station, and we should be here until 11 o'clock tonight. There's some people screaming in the background.
This is RFL.
Hi there.
Well, for the past 3 hours, or at least 2 hours and 58 minutes, because it's 2 minutes to 11, you've been tuned to London Music Radio, I hope.
Until next Sunday at 3 o'clock on 94.4, this is Radio Zodiac saying, see you.
Yeah, so this is, I suppose, kind of what the stations were like very much kind of in the when I first started listening to them, and the kind of stations that I was more into at that time. You know, so it was kind of stations that are kind of broadly kind of pop based, bit of synth pop, bit of indie, and also some of these stations around that time, like Thameside Radio, London Music Radio, were also not just kind of broadcasting from studios, but also trying to involve listeners as much as possible as well. So they were doing things like putting out occasional kind of outside broadcasts where they'd kind of meet on a kind of a park somewhere and then broadcast from there, doing phone-ins, other ways they could try and get people involved in doing it, going around to people listeners' houses and broadcasting shows from there, you know, a whole number of different ways of trying to involve their communities.
And where did they keep the transmitters and the masts? Because presumably most of the early 80s was AM. So where were they putting their AM masts? Were they on tower blocks like the FM were later on, or were the AM out in parks?
Well, the AM stations were really, I suppose, at their peak in kind of the mid-70s, late 70s. And they were broadcasting typically from parks or kind of other kind of areas and so on out in the open air. So what people would do is to kind of lug out kind of heavy kind of car batteries, transmitter equipment, long wires and so on, which they'd hide up in the trees and broadcast from there. So it wasn't really until kind of the late or kind of the early 80s, I suppose, late 70s perhaps, when FM broadcasting was coming in, that we started to then see kind of stations from tower blocks instead. Where, you know, so London is particularly good in terms of its kind of geography for being able to kind of find a tower block that's somewhere in one of the hills surrounding London and be able to broadcast from there to quite a wide area.
Absolutely, and obviously the height would be of great assistance there as well. So the second clip that we listen to now, Stephen, is from 1983 and 1984, featuring a number of commercial stations, including Radio Jackie.
Radio Jackie!
Broadcasting live from just around the corner, this is Radio Jackie on 227 metres, 1323 kilohertz.
Well, in tune with JFM on 94 megahertz, it's Brian Anthony and my special guest today, and well pleased to have him along, Roy Ayres.
Horizon Radio 102.5, Stereo FM, reaches a potential audience of 10 million Londoners every day.
Broadcasting on 1503 kHz, 7 days a week, this is Radio Sovereign, Britain's first all-gold radio.
With a time at 3 minutes past five, this is Danny Dipole reporting for Radio Shoestring News.
Broadcasting on 102.5 FM, this is Radio Shoestring, serving Lutton, Leytonstone, Wood Green and Southgate, with music, news, local, national and international.
With the sounds of tomorrow for the London of today, this is London Weekend Radio, broadcasting live on 92.5 megahertz VHF.
Dora Radio, probably the best soul station in the world.
Yeah, so this is kind of from the period of time when kind of the big commercial operators were on the air. So people like Radio Jackie, who were there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We had Radio Sovereign, who were broadcasting an oldies format. They were kind of the first kind of 7 day oldies station in the UK. We had some of the soul stations that previously had broadcast for maybe kind of 1 day, 2 days a week, then instead went to operating 24 hours a day instead. And a few other small community operators as well, like Radio Shoestring, who broadcast to North East London with kind of programming specifically for that kind of area.
Yes, I was particularly interested in the name Radio Shoestring. It sounded very pirate indeed in its philosophy. And the next clip that we're going to listen to then relates to black and minority ethnic pirate radio in London from this time.
Yeah, my room, are you on fist bread?
What?
BBC simply hear that.
Fear, silence, don't fret. System is speed coming up. Tune into Solid Groove Selection next week.
Good morning, you're listening to LGR, London Greek Radio.
Passion Radio. Broadcasted live 24 hours a day. Working for the people and not the profits.
90.2 MHz VHF par yeh Sina Radio South Hall hai.
Tropical Radio 1051 FM in stereo.
If you like soul, then you lose control when you hear Ray Sawney on JBC Radio 97 FM.
7:25 is WLR on a Saturday evening with yours truly, Smokey Joe, touching down with the best in soca music and, of course, tripping in with a little bit of reggae there earlier on.
This is WLIB, broadcasting all over London on 90.9 FM.
So around about kind of the mid-80s, we started to see a growth in stations that was targeting specifically kind of the Afro-Caribbean communities, the Greek communities, Asian communities in London. So these were people who didn't have kind of access to the media otherwise, you know, except for kind of magazines and things. Maybe there was a 1 hour a week program on Radio London or Capital Radio kind of covering this kind of music or this kind of community. So these are people who started to feel that they wanted to kind of make their mark on the airwaves as well and be able to talk to people who were like them. So we started to see a growth of those stations. You know, so we had early pioneers like DBC who broadcast from Notting Hill to the African Caribbean community there. We had stations around Tottenham and Brixton as well, where there's also strong Afro-Caribbean communities. We also, surprisingly, for some people, had a number of stations targeting kind of the Greek and Greek Cypriot communities. So a lot of people had come to London kind of after kind of the problems they'd been in Cyprus. And one club DJ, George Power, decided that he wanted a station that was broadcasting to the Greek community in London and set out to kind of to build a station, London Greek Radio, to do so, which still exists today as a legal community station. And also we had a number of Asian stations as well, such as Sina Radio, who later on were given the license and became Sunrise Radio, you know, and now broadcast kind of across the UK on DAB as well.
Very good. And the final clip then that we have is from a slightly later period, I think, Stephen, I'm open to correction on this, but it seems to be more from the early 90s, which relates to rave stations, stations promoting that type of music. We'll have a listen now.
FM 239 in your dial across London town. DJ Rats giving you the sound of the underground. Let's do it.
On Saturday, the 10th of November, there will be a massive all-night warehouse party taking place somewhere in the heart of the metropolis.
You're tuned to Cineforce Radio, 88.3 FM. Keep it locked, number one in London.
Endurance is holding this rave in a legal venue. Come and spend a tenner to get in Endurance at the North London Arches. It's going to be tremendous.
Thank you for your support at the Freedom to Party campaign on Saturday, the 27th of January at Trafalgar Square.
On Saturday, the 10th of March, 1990, the Corporation of New Generation presents a night filled with musical madness.
Everybody knows Sunrise Radio is London's number one.
Yeah, so around kind of the acid house kind of explosion of 87, 88, we started to see a number of stations that were broadcasting specifically aimed at people who were kind of going to raves and were interested in that kind of music. So whereas before, kind of a lot of the music that was played on kind of the dance music, soul music stations was very much kind of geared towards kind of American music. Here we had stations that were often kind of allied to kind of a new sound that was appearing, being made by people who were there in London as well. So it was quite a step change, I suppose, really, in the Pirates. Rather than kind of following music that was coming from elsewhere, they were there very much promoting music that was from kind of a similar community, and with the Pirates doing a lot of the pushing of that music out to people, you know, and also promoting the various raves and so on that were going on as well. So the two of them kind of started to have kind of a symbiotic relationship, really, you know, between the music that was appearing, the rave events that were happening, and the stations that were broadcasting. So this was kind of around sort of 87, 88 that they were started to come in, and really kind of it set the template for a lot of kind of how pirate radio would sound for a number of years later, you know. So through the 90s, you had stations that were very much based in a similar way, you know, so kind of around kind of live mixing. And later on, kind of bringing in MCs and so on just into the studio as well, kind of alongside that. So it was. I know I find particularly listening to kind of what was going on with the Pirates round about kind of the late 70s, early 80s, and then suddenly this huge change that there was in the late 80s. It's this whole different world that you hear and what's there on the air.
Yeah, and I think the Pirates definitely pushed that whole music scene, didn't they? So between the fact that they were broadcasting illegally and encouraging raves that wouldn't go down well with a lot of respectable Radio 4 listeners and so on, they must have been getting lots of attention for all the wrong reasons, perhaps, at this time.
yes, I mean, the stations around that time, because of their involvement in raves, which were being heavily, there was a lot of kind of heavy police activity in trying to stop them. So as a result, you had kind of policemen whose day job was to sit there listening to these stations, trying to find out what events were happening so they could try and get there to close them down beforehand. And we also had some cases as well where the police believed that stations were kind of involved in distributing drugs to some of these events, and some quite kind of heavy action that took place because of that against the stations. You know, so we saw people like Centre Force who were raided at one point and taken to court as part of this grand alleged conspiracy involving kind of them bringing in drugs from outside the country and distributing via raves that they promoted via the station, a lot of which was complete nonsense. But, you know, there was, I suppose, a lot of fear around that time, you know, in terms of what kind of was going on with young people.
Absolutely. And I think raids, though, of course, took place throughout the period, Stephen, didn't they? I mean, you've had some quite dramatic clips on your website of raids, not just in the late 80s and early 90s, but also from earlier in the 80s as well. So there was an ongoing cat and mouse situation with the authorities, wasn't there?
In the early days, when a lot of stations were broadcasting on medium wave from fields, it was perhaps kind of more kind of a fun kind of cat and mouse game. Whereas later on, when stations were operating from tops of tower blocks with hidden transmitters kind of connecting them back to studios that were in secret locations elsewhere, you started to then, I suppose, see kind of a disconnect between what was kind of going on with people in their broadcasting and what was happening on the tower blocks where the authorities would go around and pick up transmitters and so on. There also were you know, occasional incidents where some of the raids did turn nasty. I mean, in Radio Jackie's case, one of the DTI inspectors, or the Home Office inspectors at that time, punched one of the members of Radio Jackie, which led to a court case against them. But also you saw cases later on in the 80s where stations were broadcasting and making quite a lot of money, didn't want to have the authorities kind of take them off the air, because they didn't want to kind of lose the cash that was coming in from them. So around that time, you started to see perhaps some cases where some of the officials who were coming after stations were being threatened, you know, with kind of action.
We should mention your book, Stephen, as well, London's Pirate Pioneers, The Illegal Broadcasters Who Changed British Radio. What prompted you to do that? It's an enormous amount of work, absolutely encyclopedic insight into all of the stations, hundreds and hundreds of them throughout the years.
Well, I've been very much kind of away from the pirate scene for a long time. So I've been kind of involved in kind of internet startups and things, and that had kind of taken over my life, really. But then round about 2014, 2015, there had started to be some interest in what had happened back in the 80s with stations. And the ICA, the Institute for Contemporary Arts in London, were putting on an exhibition about the pirate stations of the 80s. And from that, it seemed that no one had written a book yet which really explained kind of what had happened and kind of the significance of the stations. So I happened to be kind of in a kind of a gap between kind of work, and decided I would kind of set to and write the history of it. So it was kind of several months of fairly intensive work in tracking down all these things that had gone on and trying to tell the story in a way that was interesting and also covered some of the kind of the, I suppose not just kind of the chronological side, but kind of all the other influences that happened in there as well. You know, so things like the changes in technology that happened over time, which made the pirates possible, how the music had changed during this time, things around how London's population had changed as well, you know, so the growth of the ethnic minority communities in London and them kind of asserting more power perhaps in getting onto the airwaves. So all these various factors that had come together to make pirate radio what I felt was kind of a very interesting phenomenon.
And was there much connection with Ireland through this time, Stephen? I mean, many of the leading lights in Irish radio were English, people like Chris Carey being the best example. But there also was a huge amount of emigration from Ireland to London in the 80s. You know, there was an entire lost generation in those years. So to what extent is there evidence of connection with Ireland there?
Well, I think there's some people who've been involved in London pirates have kind of moved to Ireland, I think, to go and broadcast there. So we've seen a few people from I suppose, more towards kind of the late 70s, early 80s kind of time period. And also transmitter suppliers in London, who were supplying the London Pirates, were also providing equipment for some of the Irish stations as well. I know of a couple of engineers who would go out to Ireland occasionally and kind of set up new studios and transmitters for stations. And we did have occasional kind of Irish pirates in London too. You know, there was London Irish Community Radio, I think it was, who were broadcasting in around 87, 88, who were aimed very much at kind of the Irish community in London. And a few other stations as well, like JBC, for example, who were, though primarily an Afro-Caribbean broadcaster operating in Brent, that's also an area which has quite a large kind of traditional Irish community. And they had a two-hour-a-week programme as well aimed at that community.
So the pirates today, then, you've mentioned a few times that, you know, you can still hear them. We still have them in Ireland. There's relatively few now, but Dublin still has a fairly respectable number of pirates. So what is the current situation in London and why are they still there, do you think?
I suppose the pirates that are left in London now tend to be kind of people who've been doing it for so long, they just don't want to give up, you know. So we've got quite a lot of people who go back to kind of early 90s, you know, so some of the stations have got kind of histories now of like 20, 25 years of operating. And also you've got other groups who maybe are still find it hard to get onto the airwaves. So there've been kind of occasional stations broadcasting to London's Polish community, for example, who maybe would find it hard to get a license. And also kind of the Afro-Caribbean community has not really succeeded terribly well in being able to have kind of legal radio stations in London. So we've had Choice FM, for example, that was aimed at that, but then has become part of Capital Radio as Capital Extra and really has moved away from what its kind of core kind of format was from before. So we have a number of those stations that still continue to broadcast and also aiming perhaps at an older audience who really are kind of don't have kind of the advertiser interest on for legal stations or community stations. So they still continue to broadcast today as pirates.
And finally, Stephen, just looking back over the years and all of your experience of this scene, what do you think its broader significance was beyond simply the radio aspect? I mean, what was its cultural and social impact on London life?
I guess the biggest significance, I suppose, is around the music, you know. So certainly from kind of the late 80s and the start of the rave scene there, and then through other music like the grime, dubstep, UK garage, various kind of music forms since then, we have been very much kind of a key part of the pirates. So culturally, you know, the way London's music has sounded probably wouldn't be the same if it wasn't for the pirates who started around that time.